Welcome to our interviewee for this episode of Gregarious Mammal Podcast. And we have, now, how do you pronounce your surname? Because a bit of me makes me think it's a Germanic surname, but right. I'm not 100% sure. So how do you pronounce your surname?
Launer.
Launer. So
it's
Launer.
Like a two-syllable word, which is almost three. It's like a kind of hour. Yeah. So I say, but it's actually from Switzerland.
Swiss. So do you have umlauts over the... You?
No. I grew up in Yorkshire, so Launer. Right, Launer.
Oh no.
I was about to ask because I was saying thinking Leicester or Leeds.
Sheffield. Yeah.
Now Paul is from a company, a project called BioMonkey.
Right, yeah.
Which will let's start with you telling us what BioMonkey is or what you want it to be.
Yeah, so it's more what I want it to be than what it is. So BioMonkey is essentially a biohacking coaching company. So I'm being trained by Bulletproof for Bulletproof Coaching Training course. So I'll be a Bulletproof coach. So I'll be helping people be their best selves and feel their best by giving them all kinds of advice that if they want it, essentially. But I'll be selling Bulletproof products. I'll be selling like ozone therapy devices and anything really, biotech. I'm setting up a biohacking center here in Berlin. So I'll be doing like liquid nitrogen, ice cream workshops and cooking workshops, nutrition workshops. So anything to do with science-y nutrition, basically.
Okay. So this is where we already... So the reason why we were interested in having a chat in the first place was... Amongst the many, many, many meetups we now have in Berlin, mm-hmm. your one popped up and said biohacking. And Kate and I's impression of biohacking, mostly because of where Kate has been to and her interest, has been the more technological side.
Right.
I actually met a guy in CBIT who had, I think, 14 implants in his hands. And you could see them. It was a bit... strange to look at for opening doors, RFID chips, NFCs, right. All sorts of things.
But why 14? Did they all have a different function?
Or they all had a different function.
Or
yeah.
Was he were some of them obsolete and he hadn't taken them out yet?
Who knows? Who knows? I think he was possibly on the extreme side. Yeah. But this is the interesting thing about a lot of the kind of the more technological side of the biohackers is they kind of follow a bit along with
Transhumanists,
like pushing the envelope of what humans are going to be.
But
before we let's just keep this train going just for a minute. So that has always been our impression of what biohacking was.
Sure.
I don't know where the term originated, but that's generally been our impression because we're mainly tech people. So that's generally been our impression. So that's usually what we thought: people augmenting themselves with some kind of technology.
Mm.
And then recently we've noticed this usage of biohacking in, I guess, what us as not very aware people of this sort of field, we would think of as a diet or nutrition advice or something like that.
Yeah.
So is there a difference between things like traditional dieting and nutrition advice and now the more recent use of the word biohacking? Or is it essentially the same with a new spin? Or what's the actual difference between those various fields?
Well, I think I would say generally it's all biohacking, right? So for me, biohacking is optimizing the inputs, all of the inputs into our body so that we feel at our best and live long. So right now, I'm feeling slightly nervous. So I suppose I'm being interviewed, I'm on camera. I've got a slightly nervous swallowing thing. So if I was to look around now, think about the lighting. Well, it's not really that sunny today. I've noticed that I'm much more relaxed when I've got full spectrum light. There's something that I ate this morning which has left me feeling slightly inflamed. And so I need to kind of optimize all of that. So what's the air like in here? Is there mold somewhere? I don't know. I suffer from adrenal fatigue slightly, so I need to optimize a bit better my B vitamins. I'm in ketosis all the time. I don't do carb refeeds. I should do, sorry, Dave. all that kind of stuff. How did I sleep last night? So that's kind of biohacking. Biohacking can also be using biotech, like I have a cerebral electrostimulation device, so I'll put these on my ears and electric frequencies go through my head. And yeah, why not update something in your body? But personally, that type of biohacking doesn't really interest me that much, because it seems, I look at it and I kind of think, well, what's the point really? Why do I want to put something in my body if it's not really going to help? And putting something foreign in your body, I would say, is going to basically send your immune system a bit wired, trying to kick it out of your body. It's just not natural. So kind of biohacking I'm interested in is more working out what Mother Nature wants us to do and trying to match that. Whereas biohacking is just, I don't know, like technological people just having fun, really. Although they're not going to like that. But interestingly, I was really interested when you asked me to do this podcast, because our first Biohacker Berlin social meeting, this guy came up, turned up, and he was really disappointed because he was really interested in what biohacking as in implants and stuff, and basically thought all the stuff we were talking about was quackery, and he just wanted pure, like, and so he didn't like the fact that we'd appropriated the term, essentially. So I wasn't aware of that until I got this invite for this interview, until this guy turned up and basically science trolled us live.
Wow. It's interesting you say that. I mean, I have been interested in biohacking for a long time. And my interest came about from wearable technology. The idea that you could wear pieces of technology, whether sensors, forms of devices.
Like a Fitbit or something.
Yeah. Yeah, like this one.
Yeah.
And you could use it to get data on your body, your physiological self.
That's cool.
And it may be data that previously you've not been able to access, or that scientifically you've not been able to access. I think personally what appeals to me about biohacking is the idea that we've got all this knowledge and we can become our own self-aware kind of conduit, so that rather than all the knowledge being at the hands of medical professionals, we're able to have some of that knowledge ourselves. I see it in terms of there being a lot of common sense with a lot of this stuff as well, so that, you know, you're able to obviously use wearables to monitor yourself, but also to be aware of risks. Like, I think that you made some interesting points with the implants, that they can your body reject an implant? And it's interesting, you know, because I've always been quite interested in implants personally. And I see, you know, you can think of them as a continuum of some of the other things that people get implanted anyway, from people that are involved in the more extreme side of piercing and those sort of things, to people that get things like cochlear implants or false hips or false knees or, you know.
Well, yeah.
All that sort of stuff. And I asked this guy who had this big, honking, huge implant in his hand. I always thought the hand is, whilst one of the most convenient, has got to be one of the most painful spots, because firstly, you put all your nerve sensors in the fingertips. I know from having had third-degree burns myself, only got a few scars now, luckily. Yeah, they hurt like fuck. Even if you burn the nerves off, they still hurt.
Oh, good, we can swear, can we?
Yeah, well, I just... Awesome. I'm Australian.
Great.
But yeah, you know, like the hand has got to be one of the worst spots. And I asked him about, why didn't your body try and reject it? And because, you know, you hear of people getting a piercing and your body just pretty much pushes it out. And no, I was able to keep it in. So, you know, I always say to people, if they're going to go to that, anything that involves putting something into your body, whether it's food or some type of herb or supplement, like, you know, people you talk about, hear about people with turmeric implants lately.
Turmeric?
Yeah, the spice or root, I'm not sure which part of the plant it is, to, you know, putting stuff physically in your body, whether it's an implant or something else.
Well, then it slowly releases turmeric into your bloodstream.
Yeah,
okay.
Basically.
Cool.
You just got to be really careful, because, you know, and you could say the same for naturopathy, arguably. I mean, I hear people talking about, oh, you know,
so
say no to big pharma and get
so
some...
Actually, well, this is an interesting point. So where does... I guess probably the answer is going to be it depends on the person and many other things. But like, where does biohacking become extreme drug taking, when or addiction even, you know, that's possibly, that's definitely probably a whole other area. But, you know, is biohacking taking cocaine every 10 minutes because it keeps you awake? Is biohacking drinking a shit ton of coffee because it keeps you awake? Like, when, what do you see as kind of the boundaries, I suppose? Or what's the most precise definition you can think of?
I think I would draw the line very clearly. Does it do yourself, does it do you or others harm?
Mm-hmm.
And can you control it? I would say that. That's the line.
Okay. Mm. So control is, that's a good point. Control is certainly a very good point.
Is it beneficial for you?
Yeah.
If you're doing it and actually it's really not beneficial at all, that's got to be towards addiction.
Okay.
Or why are you doing it?
It's a good point. And when you think of things like microdosing, the idea that you can take minute doses of, was it Special K?
LSD.
It was one of the drugs. I mean, clearly
LSD,
I'm not the most clued up on the psychotropics. As a way to kind of monitor or manage. No, that's not the right term. Sorry, I'm going to rephrase that.
Enhance.
Harness, right?
Yeah. Harness. But your energy and your mood, I think that's what they were going for. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Focus and creativity, I think, was your main thing.
Yeah, but it is interesting because I know that there is a number of research projects at the moment looking at drugs like Special K and LSD being used for people with severe drug resistance.
Special K.
What, you mean the cereal?
ketamine. Sorry, I'm used to it being called Special K. Ketamine is like a horse tranquilizer,
right?
From memory.
Yeah.
But being used in, and again, we're talking very regulated, researched kind of stuff for people with drug resistant depression. And these are people who have, I might add, in the past either been subject to fairly intensive treatments like.
ECG.
Electroshock.
Yeah. ECT. Sorry.
ECT.
I knew it was on the tip of my tongue. ECT, or alternatively, the brain implants, which is a newer one that's been considered to be very effective.
Well, here's an interesting question: is taking medication for bipolar biohacking?
I suppose it is, really, but I think what's a key difference between, say, normal medicine, which the doctor might give you, and say a biohacker's approach, we look at the causes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
What's the fundamental issue? Why is this happening?
Yeah.
We're not just going to say, okay, this is happening, you have this, this drug will stop that. Because if you don't fix why you've got problem X or issue X, then you are just going to like put a band-aid over it, and then it's going to manifest itself some other way.
Okay, yeah. So I guess actually kind of joining up maybe some of the two sides of where maybe we've both, all three of us have come from in terms of the term biohacking is that you're interested in optimizing the inputs into you and some of the other aspects of biohacking, although I'd actually probably call it quantitative self, really, to be precise.
I would say that's very much
disproving, hopefully, whether... Yeah. Optimizing the inputs has made a difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's great.
And a question related. I mean, you mentioned, Chris mentioned diet and you mentioned ketosis. Mm. Where do you think the interest in the low carb, diet movement or health movement has come from? And why is it so predominant in people involved in biohacking?
Good question. Results, I would say. It just works. Like for losing fat, I can't think of a better way than ketosis, dependent on possible other factors, but it just works so incredibly well.
And can you describe what it means to listeners that might not be familiar with the concept?
Ketosis is essentially when your body uses fat for fuel instead of sugar. Essentially it's that.
And my understanding is to get to that state, it requires a... no sugar, no carb diet, is that correct?
Yeah, so you're normally supposed to eat less than 50 grams of carbs, which is a very small amount. So considering if you have, I don't know, like a 100 gram bar of chocolate, that's probably 50 grams of carbs already.
So, I mean, do you think, is there a reason that our, I wouldn't even say our modern diets, but human diets up until this point have generally been so possibly bad for us? I don't know. It feels like sometimes now we say a lot of things that are bad for us that, as far as I can tell, have been in our diets for a long time. Doesn't mean they were right or wrong, of course, but is it just because they were easier to grow, or?
Well, we say a long time. What do you define a long time?
Well, like carbs, for example, seems to be generally,
like, which ones you
considered
mean, like,
a bad idea these days, but we've had breads and grains and things with high carb value for quite a while.
Like rice.
Yeah, I mean, just China. Wheat and things like that. It's just because we just didn't know any better, basically. Or are they, I don't know. I guess, why more recently have we started challenging the old paradigms? Because we have the ability to do so, I suppose?
This is kind of like the kind of paleo approach now. So the idea is, what did we do when we were running around the forest? And what we were doing was killing an animal, stuffing our face, all kinds of fat and animal product, and then, I don't know, grabbing some vegetables somehow. We weren't doing mass agriculture. So that's actually, in the history of the human being, is a relatively recent thing.
Yeah, all right.
So the idea is we're not designed to feed ourselves from carbs. We're designed to have nothing to eat while we're hunting, and then to eat a load of fat, basically.
Yeah. And so animal. Even like the concept of three meals a day is probably just what we've got used to in the modern existence. It may not be the best way to do things.
Well, I eat once a day.
Okay.
So it depends on the person. Yeah. So I, through excessive ketosis, I had problems with adrenal fatigue, which I still have now. I can fix that, but it's something to be aware of, because I stress my body because I fast every single day. Mm-hmm. And then I eat. So I kind of have like a 24-hour fast.
Okay.
Every day.
How's your immune system as a consequence? If that's not too personal a question.
No. Well, I'm not sure how I can really. I mean, I'm not looking at the markers for that, but I, you know, I'm very. I don't have any health problems or such. I don't get ill.
Sure.
No more or less than normal, or you would say maybe even slightly less than normal. Whatever normal is.
I would say, well, I hear what is normal, but. I don't have any indications that there's an issue with that.
It's interesting. I have heard similar responses from people who've changed their diet in all kinds of ways. Like people who've gone vegan, for example, or people that have removed something from their diet, whether it's dairy or alcohol or something else. But it shows that there is not one size fits all for any type of food program or diet, whatever term you want to use. And I think that, you know, when we talk about the idea of the age of when certain types of food have come into play, you can't remove the reality of how powerful advertising and the food lobbies are, particularly in America and the Western countries. You know, they've got people telling you for how many years that carbs are good and fat's bad or whatever. You know, you could pick any type of argument and find it an opposite. And I think one of the interesting things that biohacking as a movement does encourage, whether it's through using wearable devices or food or journal, even old-fashioned journaling, writing down things, is being aware of yourself, being able to monitor yourself, whether you're using an app to monitor your sleep, and you might be connecting that with wearing a sleep monitor of some sort, or you're simply having a dream journal, or you're a food diary, or however you choose to do it. And I think that's quite a positive thing. It's people taking some ownership of their health in for themselves. And, you know, people can ultimately choose what they do. I mean, I like to drink wine. I'm still going to drink wine, unfortunately. Mm. Even if I know that drinking wine is the worst thing to do for good sleep. And I know I'm not alone in that one. So I think that's something I like about the body hacking movement, and the idea that we see people also using, you do have serious health conditions. Diabetes is a very good example. Diabetes is probably one of the most funded health conditions in terms of tech at the moment. We see everything from every end of the spectrum, from preventative diabetes, pre-diabetes, type 1 and 2, devices to monitor people's glucose and also treat diabetes, because of course we can't actually cure diabetes. And I think an issue there is people using the glucose monitors as a way to measure their body's response when they eat certain foods, whether they're a diabetic or not, is quite interesting. Spoken to a number of people who've been involved in doing that.
I mean, I would say, you say you can't cure diabetes, I would say you can.
Yeah.
There's many cases.
I was thinking type 1 specifically.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Type 2 you can, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, ketosis for reversing diabetes, type 2. There's loads of cases of that.
That's
type
true.
1,
I agree.
I'm less familiar with.
Yeah, type 1 is perhaps got different causes than diet alone.
So how much, let's take you as an example.
Sure.
So you're the best example you can think of, I'm sure.
Well, I don't know about that, but we'll see.
How much time would you say that you spend on a daily basis kind of monitoring the effect that inputs are having to your body?
Actually, not as much as I should do.
Okay.
I've been experimenting with the inputs and not so much tracking. It's been more tracking how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So a bit more kind of holistic, I suppose. So I don't have... I haven't really quantified myself. So I want to do 23andMe genetic testing. I want to be tracking my blood glucose. I haven't started doing that. I haven't even been tracking my ketones. Mm. So not much, to be honest, but I track how I feel in response to my inputs.
Okay. So actually, I might continue down this path and then I'll ask you a much more pragmatic question related to that. Do you wonder if in yourself or in some personalities it could lead to a little bit bordering on paranoia about, you know, constantly, you know, I think we all have somewhat addictive personalities, and the modern world makes it very easy to keep checking the outcomes of things. So is there a tendency sometimes to maybe go a bit too far?
Well, I suppose you have to ask, does that fit in with the life you want? And at the end of the day, that's what it depends on. But are you referring to like orthorexia type?
I'm not sure, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's what Chris means, where people, because they're eating certain ways, become very obsessed and it changes their brain chemistry.
No, I meant just like, you know, I can on a daily basis, if I said something on social media, I'm maybe checking every few minutes to see if anyone replied. I'm kind of talking that level of...
Do you mean more narcissistic?
No, so the same thing of like, I ate something, what effect did it have on me? Did it have the effect on me now? You know, kind of just like constant, maybe it's something else causing that, but just the element of the fact that you're constantly trying things and checking things, so it can end up dominating your life a bit too much sometimes, maybe. I'm not sure. And it very much depends on personality, of course, but... yeah, I don't know if you had any personal experience of maybe you at a certain point thinking, I'm actually causing more damage to myself worrying about it than not even doing it, maybe.
Well, I love it. I love all that stuff. I think really, from a bulletproof coaching perspective, we would look at that as what do you want?
Yeah.
And what is your like purpose? What do you really, really want? Like, get in tune with your emotions, bring yourself out of your head, make sure you're working towards the life you want. And if all this checking and such is excessive and it's getting in the way of, for instance, starting a family, maybe you want to rethink that.
Yeah.
But if it's taking where you want to go, then okay. Fine.
I think there's a bit of a continuum with this stuff. And like, I know I spoke to a startup, and I won't mention too many details because they're well known in the movement. And one of their interests is fasting. And
right.
The whole company would fast for extended periods. And I said to them, I said, you know, I can't remember exactly the words I used, but, you know, I'm quite a tactful person with interviews. I sort of said, look, you know, I notice most of the people are male in your company. Do you have women? I know that women spend a lot of time worrying about the way they look and their body and what they eat. And that can have, for a lot of women, very negative consequences.
Fasting.
Yeah. It could go into disordered eating and things like that. How do you mitigate this, you know, particularly if you're in a company where it's seen as company culture to fast and everyone's kind of egging everybody on? And I was really quite shocked when the person said to me, well, I never thought of that.
It's probably the manifestation of a hot, completely different problem.
And this was someone who was kind of, I'll phrase carefully, someone who thought they were a bit of a leader in the movement. So I was a little bit shocked to hear that this wasn't something considered, because, you know, I see mental health as a key part of a lot of biohacking, and that something that should be, you know, good mental health should be monitored and maintained and encouraged in all people.
But why were they fasting? Were they fasting to lose weight and look shredded, or?
No, they thought it increased their vitality and their ability to work, their clarity of thought, and a few other reasons.
I mean, no doubt. I mean, if it's done well, it's got lots of benefits.
Sure.
Getting rid of the rubbish from the body, autophagy, for instance, detoxing, getting rid of fat, all kinds of things.
I actually think it's something you said in that sentence almost slightly contradicted something else you said, which I found interesting. In that you said about the way women look is I know, I mean, I perfectly understand. It's a constant source of angst for a lot of women because of media and businesses and fashion and all these sorts of things. But actually, you said they were doing it to make themselves feel mentally more aware, and there was no discussion of the way people looked. So
no, you're not quite understanding me. I was saying this company was doing it for those reasons.
Yeah.
However, we know statistically that when women are encouraged to fast, it can go very wrong. For example, you have programs like in Australia, we have the 40-hour famine, where people are encouraged from a young school age to fast for 40 hours. You know, not a long period, but to you know, solve world hunger by fasting and getting donations. 80% of the participants are women, are young schoolgirls. Mm-hmm. Like, women from a young age are rewarded for fasting and for, you know, abstaining and for regulating their bodies and their diet.
All right, okay.
So I can now see, you know, a few issues. Okay. But that said, I mean, what you're, I think what you're proposing is more of a considered positive program where there's training involved, there's consideration, there's thought. It's not just jumping in and, you know, being
someone to guide you through a process is always good, if it's especially to do with fitness things, because you can easily overdo it.
And I think sometimes having someone else involved who's not, you know, in your immediate circle could be very helpful, because they can see things that you may not see. You may have all this data and be able to regulate, you know, okay, I know what how much I sleep, and I know what happens if I do certain things or what have you, or if I don't. But to get that insight, sometimes you need actual people from, you know, to see another side of things.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, I think fasting is very helpful. If you fast, it can drastically reduce your chances, for instance, of getting cancer.
Sure.
Because you can essentially clean out lactic acidosis buildup, free radicals, all kinds of things. But you have to be careful with it, because it's a stress to the body, which is why it's effective, but it can also cause a lot of stress to your adrenals. It can cause, well, temporarily it can cause fertility issues with women. And so it has to be managed, essentially. But essentially it's a very healthy thing to be doing. It's something that we've been doing as humans for ages. I mean, 40 hours is not really very long.
No,
exactly. There's a lot of those kind of common numbers about how long a human can survive without certain things. And food is like 3 days. No, or even longer maybe, but 3 days.
Oh, it's wait really long.
Yeah.
You can survive a long time without food.
Yeah. Okay, let's circle back to some kind of more practical questions. The first one would be, I know you've already kind of said that maybe you're not tracking the outcomes of your input as quantitatively as you could or should.
Sure.
But if someone were to ask you, like, devices or things like that, you would recommend for doing those sorts of things? Do you have any that come to mind that you would particularly recommend to people?
I think a simple heart rate monitor is interesting. Like, this is a Fitbit. To see just how you respond, really. And you can use this actually in a way to see what your sleep was like, because if you slept for 8 hours then you look at what your heart rate was like, you can see when you woke up and such. It's quite obvious according to the heart rate.
Yeah. Okay.
I would say. Let me think. Devices. Some kind of sleep tracking app. You can get apps or headsets or something. There's one, I can't remember the name, of course, because I'm in the middle of a podcast.
We can add it later.
There's a new one with a, it's a new type of headphone which tracks your brain waves.
Mm.
What's it called? Something like Tahoo or?
I think I know the one you mean.
It's like 200 quid. Anyway, so that'd be good. Weight, I mean, it's not so weight that's interesting. I think it'd be good to track your bone density and your like using a DEXA for instance, or your BMI, so your, you know, your fat percentage of fat in your body, just to compare to see how your diet's doing. But very important is how you feel essentially.
Okay, so here's my final kind of possibly one or two, depending if Kate wants to participate.
I've got a question.
Okay, let's go for your question, and then I think I've got a kind of rounding question.
One thing I always ask people in biohacking, because I talk to lots of people in different sides of it, is there something that is not trackable at the moment that you would like to be trackable?
Oh, yeah.
It's a hard one. Feel free to think about it and come back to us with that one.
Yeah, again, I'm in the middle of a podcast. I'm struggling to really think of it, to be honest. But loads of things all the time. Mm. None of them are coming to my mind right now.
Okay.
You know what? The one that comes up a lot is blood, to do with the blood. And if you think of Theratus, I think that's how you pronounce it, the startup company in Silicon Valley that we all know was a bit of a failure when it revealed that their testing was highly highly problematic and basically fraud. They were basically trying to make it so that any blood test could be done through a prick fingerprint, a bit like you would for diabetes.
I would like that, yeah.
Yeah, super fast results, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll put a link to the whole debacle there for people to read it. It is an interesting one.
Maybe we'll let people delve into that further. So my final question from our side, depending on what if Kate wants to participate, and you'll get it in a minute, and then one from you just wrapping up anything you want to tell people. Okay, putting you completely on the spot here, if you haven't enough already, you know, with no kind of analysis or anything like that. So one of the reasons I was sort of also interested in speaking to you is as I've got a bit older, I also do sometimes feel like there's a few things I could do better. I would like to improve with the way I feel.
Mm.
So, okay, take, for example, the classic, like many other people, but especially for me when it gets a bit later in the afternoon, I start getting quite drowsy.
Sure.
Is there a very obvious thing you would recommend for maybe fixing that? Or is it just having a sleep? Could be it. Some kind. Is there a biohacking solution that you can think of that might help with
that? So you mean like the 4 p.m. blood sugar drop?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Well, tell me, what do you eat for breakfast and lunch? And when do you do that?
Well, it varies, but generally breakfast is muesli, yogurt, some fruit, probably about 7:38.
Right.
Lunch varies wildly, but sometime about 12:31.
You eat pretty healthy, though.
Well, sometimes.
And so what do you have for lunch? Because so far you've told me carbs.
Mm.
Carb-loaded breakfast.
Mm.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going, and I would probably say that lunch is probably not that much better. So,
but you probably have burger or pasta or something, don't you?
So you're probably, I guess you're saying cut the carbs a bit.
Well, if I ate like that, I wouldn't be able to concentrate, and I would also be feeling very tired.
Yeah, okay.
Mid-morning and mid-afternoon, and that's why I don't actually eat at all during the day.
Yeah, no, I can understand that.
But we'll have my massive bulletproof coffee with loads of butter in. So that's kind of lots of fat energy, and that works for me. But I used to get that every single day when I used to eat like a normal carby diet, and I just didn't understand why.
Yeah. Okay. I think I'm a simple one. Kate, do you have a particular thing that you'd like to get a very, very quick, unguaranteed diagnosis?
No, I'm good.
You're good.
Thank you.
Okay. I mean, yeah.
There's all kinds of other potential inputs, but the fact that you just told me you eat carbs for breakfast, that puts your body in carb burning mode. So essentially your blood sugar is doing this all day.
Yeah. Okay.
It's an insulin glucose war.
Yeah. Yep. Related to that, I actually did the whole 30 for nearly 30 days. And I found that really hard, actually. Breakfast was probably the hardest one because I don't eat eggs. And you're eating so much meat. And when you're used to more of a vegan diet and there's loads of eggs, you're like, whoa.
So but are you still a vegan?
No.
I used to be vegan.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's how I first got adrenal fatigue, because I didn't have so many things, yeah. Particularly B vitamins. Mm. And I only just realized that in the past few weeks, actually.
Yeah. Mm.
If I think back to it. So veganism, and then ketosis, without my carb refeeds. So in the Bulletproof diet, we suggest about once every week or 10 days, you have a carb day where you carb refeed to make sure your adrenal gland, for instance, is supported,
mm-hmm.
and your body's not too stressed. But then most of the time, you'd be in a low carb diet and like under 150 grams a day or less, or 50 for ketosis.
Okay.
But so I'm a bit extreme though, so I didn't do the carb refeeds because I feel so great normally. Like right now, I feel really nervous because I'm on a podcast, I wasn't really respecting the wisdom, shall we say, of the Bulletproof diet. Whereas, so I need to be a bit more quantified about it.
And the science behind it, I guess.
Yeah.
Follow what the science says, huh?
So you've come on our podcast, we've made you nervous.
Yeah.
You've taken,
No, sorry. I'm making myself nervous. You're lovely.
You're incredibly eloquent, though.
We've taken 50 minutes of your time on a public holiday. So
yeah, we do
tell
apologize.
Us what you'd like to promote. What are you up to? What would you like to tell people that you're working on?
Well, right now, I've started a group here in Berlin called Biohacker Berlin, which is how you guys found me. So that's a social thing, really.
Fantastic.
And also, we're going to be doing things like I'm going to try and organize a group hyperbaric oxygen session.
Oh, really?
I don't know if I can manage that, but who knows? Group cryotherapy session.
Yeah, cool.
We've got a biohacking party on the 27th of April in collaboration with Better House,
which we're hoping to encourage Kate to speak at.
Me?
Well, yeah, I mean,
if you need a speaker, consider it.
Not a speaker as such, but if there's something interesting to share, because it's going to be like a party atmosphere.
I think it's more it's a party, Chris.
Presentations
and stuff.
No, it's not really presentations.
You can show some examples of... Anyway, it's a hard discussion.
So I'll be there with ozonating water and giving it out. I've got an ozonating machine coming from Australia. I'm going to be, if I get the liquid nitrogen delivered in time, I'll be doing liquid nitrogen ice cream.
That stuff is super fun.
Have you heard of get some Bulletproof, get some ice cream?
Yeah.
So I'll be doing that for people. And there's going to be these guys called Sonorari with a sound massage chair.
Oh, yeah.
We're also going to be there this Saturday, the 15th of April, at Simply Keto for our social event.
Great.
So I hope to see you there.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on. And then when I get my biohacking center set up, I'll be doing all of these workshops, nutrition workshops in my center.
So how can people stay? Do you have a website or a preferred social media profile or something where people can keep up to date with these activities?
You can follow the Biohacker Berlin Facebook group. That's Biohacker Berlin, not Biohackers Berlin. Singular.
Bit of competition there.
Because oddly, there's another group. But
I noticed. Yeah. It's confusing.
It's very Monty Python. And BioMonkey Facebook page.
Okay.
And then the BioMonkey website, which is basically empty because it's all very new.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
So Paul is still with us, and he's actually going to, because we're lucky enough to actually have someone in the studio with us.
Yay!
And we even have our friend Ginger over here. She's actually somehow stayed throughout the whole recording.
Say hello, Ginger.
She even likes The stranger we have in the studio. We're going to talk through our topics of the week together. Paul had absolutely no idea what we were talking about, but we'll see.
No idea. Which is great. I feel much more relaxed because I don't really feel like I have to participate.
No.
Which means I probably will more.
Participate at will or as little as you like.
So interestingly, Kate joined me at one meetup, and I went to a second one yesterday. There's a lot of interest at the moment in Berlin on voice interfaces and developing, designing, productizing for voice interfaces. We actually have an Echo over there, which we haven't set up yet, but we do have one. And both of the meetups we went to were actually around more the product side, the how to design products that work in voice interfaces.
Yep.
And we talked a little bit in the last episode, last week, about voice interfaces for people who traditionally have not found computer interfaces quite so inclusive because they're visual or require dexterity that you weren't able to use. So voice interfaces is a really interesting space, and we will probably talk much more about it over the next few months. But the first article kind of relating to this that we've highlighted is, and it sort of manifested itself apparently in a Daily Mail headline.
Oh, that would be pure gold then.
Which you don't normally believe.
Gee, but it must be true.
But it sparked another interesting article on AItrends.com. And it's something that I think has come up in the past too with Siri, I think. Can Alexa lie? Can voice interfaces be made to tell you things that aren't true? To spread false facts? And actually, one of the demos I saw last night kind of feeds into this a little bit. It wasn't a voice interface, but it was an AI interface where it would ask you often false questions to eliminate things as well. So sometimes AIs actually ask you the wrong thing intentionally as well, which is kind of interesting. But
can you give an example from last night?
So it was basically just picking, you thought of an animal and then it asked you questions and it tried to guess what the animal was. And so, for example, it would say, does it have stripes? And it say, does it have black and white stripes? Which is a kind of, if you followed the rest of the conversation, it was a bit irrelevant, but it's trying to eliminate a zebra, obviously. Mm. So it's sort of, sometimes AIs have this tendency to ask questions that seem a bit strange, but it's actually because it's trying to eliminate something else.
Yep.
But this actually was your link anyway, Kate. So was there anything else more you wanted to add about, can Alexa lie?
Yeah, look, I mean, if you missed the story, the storyline is actually an interesting one. Is that a woman was sitting at her computer or in the kitchen hanging out with Alexa or however you want to imagine it, and said, what was it? Do you work for the CIA or can the CIA hear me? I think it says in the article, but you just scroll. Are you connected to the CIA, Alexa? You know, I thought it was Siri, but okay. The dot she was using didn't answer. So therefore, people concluded from that Siri or Alexa, whoever it was, must be connected to the CIA. But look, the reality with this is it denotes a level of thinking that AI home devices or home automated devices, however you want to put them, don't have. They don't have this much natural language processing skills. It's basically when you ask a question, you're putting in a request to an algorithm that will try and collect results based on the words that you've said. And when they say things like, I do not know the answer to that, or I can't tell you, it's because they don't have the information on hand. But that said, like you said, there is certainly capacities for false questions and false answers, and it depends where the information is garnered from. That's one of the issues.
It's a very interesting space, I find, at the moment, because it's very new and no one really had any answers yet.
So I'm going to ask a stupid question, because this is not my field.
We don't have any stupid questions here.
But does does she know, though, if there's like a back door to the CIA? Would she know? You know, does the algorithm or the program or whatever actually know that?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't even know, have a clue how it works, but
Does the programmer let it know? This is a whole other ethical question around what do you tell your algorithm? It's very new territory. Like Alexa or the Echo. No, Alexa is the system. is very new. It's less than 2 years old. Super and new. Was pretty much beta when it was released. And it's very early days. Very, very early days. And it's interesting, but there's going to be a lot of mistakes yet.
And so, I might add, if you read my writing, you probably know I'm more of an Amazon Home fan.
Google Home.
I was thinking of both
that much
of them.
Of a fan, eh?
I was thinking of both of them at once and comparing them in my brain. Look, because I think you think of some of the bodies that Google is associated with, you know, from buying DeepMind to all kinds of stuff. And, you know, their progressions with language processing through their Google Translate, some of the other stuff they're working on behind the scenes with Google X, I think they've, you know, certainly shown that they're putting the energies and the efforts into home automation. And whilst there aren't as many products connected to Google Home as Alexa, I think that's going to be...
They are more mature. It's interesting, yeah. Actually, one of the presenters I saw at one of the meetups, and I don't want to kind of just sound like I'm bad-mouthing them, so I won't be more specific, kind of was a little... said that this is all very new territory. And actually... Like Google, you're correct. Google Home is new, but Google Voice Interaction has existed for a long time.
That's
you
right.
have to do it on Android for
yeah,
quite a while.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And a woman I was speaking to last night said, I've been doing this for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was just like, what do you mean you've been doing it for 20 years? She said, voice automation systems, customer service systems. It's not new. It's not new technology. It's just a lot faster now. That's all.
And the thinking elements as well.
Yeah, those systems you all hate. Say yes now. Yes. Do not, yeah, etc.
Yeah, oh god.
And the guy even played a joke video from the Deutsche Bahn, apparently in the 80s or 90s, tried to make a phone line where you could order tickets.
That's right.
And this guy had an accent, and it was getting absolutely nowhere with it. But
well, because we're all in Germany right now, so the German voice automation phone calls, like it's so frustrating when they say yes or no. And you say, like, yeah, or whatever. Yeah. And then, you know, in some kind of foreign accent, and they say, you did not give the correct answer. And it's really annoying because it's not like, I did give the correct answer, but you didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And that's so German to criticise the customer.
Yeah.
Like,
the
make it our fault.
The customer is wrong. Yeah.
The customer is totally wrong
it's
in Germany.
So true.
The customer is a douchebag. The customer is not king.
That was actually a great segue, going from customer to king. And it leads very, very nicely to the next topic, a little bit more jovial side of what we're just talking about. And one of the issues that often comes up on tech podcasts is when you're talking about these sorts of devices, is accidentally triggering them. And there's been lots of examples of people doing this intentionally and unintentionally. And this manifested itself and came to a head last week in an advert from Burger King. There's the King reference. I'm just going to play it so we can all hear it. We're not going to be able to see it. Paul's not going to see it.
There's not much to see.
But you can watch it yourself as well. Let's see. Oh, it's 15 seconds.
Which is unfortunately not enough time to explain all the fresh ingredients in the Whopper sandwich. But I got an idea. Okay, Google, what is the Whopper burger?
I actually think that's quite clever.
That's actually quite clever advertising. In case it's not obvious, the idea is that your Google Home device will respond appropriately and tell you what is in the Whopper burger, which it actually does in the video I saw.
But the thing I find interesting, because I don't actually see what problem Google would have with it, but they shut it down.
Yeah. part of the problem was actually Google that shut it down.
Yeah.
Part of the problem was firstly the information was coming from Wikipedia, and people had hacked or edited or whatever you want to call it. Wikipedia's the Whopper page or the Hungry Jack's page or whatever they're called, Burger King page. Sorry, they're different names, different countries. To say things like, you know, it's got rats in it and stuff like that. And you know, there have been some really, really funny cases where people have had things unwantedly ordered on their automated device. Whether it's, you know, there's a young girl saying she wanted a doll's house. And so therefore they got a doll's house sent to them. There was another one where whenever they discussed this story, people ended up getting doll's houses ordered through their automated devices.
We're going to have... So it's interesting because when people talk about hacking, you often think of these very complicated sorts of... Well, we've been talking about hacking in other ways already in the episode, but sometimes the most successful form of the negative hacking, black hat hacking, is social hacking, is bypassing. There's actually some, I think a German university announced this week that they could hijack a computer through scanning hard drive lights.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I read about
that. You could have a firewall, you could have virus protectors, and somehow by detecting the blinking light of a hard drive, you could actually access something somehow. Wow. I'm not even sure how. But, you know, and but something like this, an ad which isn't even directly connected to your device can still achieve an effect.
The other side of it is that we do all have, and it gradually be growing our slew of connected devices in our home, and some of these will be your automated or your voice activated devices, and there's a number of them being marketed for the kitchen. So things like ovens that will talk to your refrigerator, refrigerators that can order food for you when they detect that something's run out, your stovetop or your heater that cooks connects to your smart fry pan, detects that you need salmon, so it will order the salmon. But foreseeably, when you think how many connected devices, like you think, just let's pick a product, say milk. You might have a connected kettle, you might have a connected refrigerator, you might have a connected, hot water system, blah, 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 blah. You could foreseeably have all these devices ordering you stuff because they detect that something's empty.
Or someone just plays a YouTube ad and your fridge orders something for you without
you
wanting to.
But you're going to have a problem. And then, of course, there's the recycling bins that also can connect your rubbish and reorder it that way. So you could foreseeably have a problem of having, 6 litres of milk.
This actually comes back to what we were talking about earlier, Paul. I mean, could you see, or have you already seen, the potential of someone is trying a biohack, and a sensor that they're using says you don't have enough blood sugar, and without them even knowing it, orders them something they need. Do you think that gets taking it too far?
Well, no, I was just thinking the same thing. What I would like, you asked me earlier on, what would I like to see that it could be monitored? And the truth is, everything. I would like all of my markers to be measured, so that I could see, I am down on B6. I'm going to eat some spirulina or whatever. But there's an app called Chronometer, which you manually enter the food you eat, and it tells you what you've not had enough of. So you can imagine a scenario where that app was connected to your fridge or whatever, and then they ordered you some more salmon or whatever. But it's getting a bit far. But but I would like an app where you don't have to manually enter all the food.
Absolutely.
Because that is a pain in the ass, and you don't do it after a while. So I want something that you can, this is what I want. Voice recognition, say, hey, Alexa, or whoever, I'm eating salmon. I'm eating about 300 grams. I'm having about 20 grams of oil, whatever. And she just tots it all up, and then says, hey, Paul, you're putting your adrenals in at risk or whatever, and you need to eat this. That would be cool. Doesn't exist.
Actually, in some respects, a lot of the connected devices are too smart in the wrong places, maybe.
You know what? There is actually a product related to what you said. There is a couple of things. There's an app now that you can take photos of your food and it will come up with the calorie content. And there's a smarter one that...
Really?
Is actually, yeah.
Does it actually work, though?
I've never used it. I couldn't be bothered taking the photos. But the other one that I spoke to the company making it, it's basically looks like a little plate. It's actually a scale, so it's able to weigh your food to get the correct measurements. So the idea is you put the plate on it, weighs your food, you take a picture of your food.
Oh, cool.
And what actually happens is because they use AI, and there's a little video that goes with it, so I won't go into it too much, but it basically is able to distinguish the different types of food on the plate. You can say how they're cooked. But of course, once you've put them in once, it recognises them again. So you're not constantly having to say, I had mushrooms for breakfast or whatever. But they use it, their aim of using it is for people that are dieting or want, have to maintain what they eat. And it's, seems to be quite good. They've had a lot of interest from funders. They're based in Germany.
Let's push on to our next set of links. Again, a nice segue. Well done. Congratulations. We're doing very well with the segues here.
Very good.
Or maybe my brain is just awake thinking of potential segues. So we've talked a little bit here about connectivity and maybe too much of it. But the other aspect of this, and I don't know if we need to have a particularly big discussion on this, because I think this could be an entire episode in itself, and it is not the first time this has been talked about, but there's an article here on The Atlantic from last week about loneliness begetting loneliness, the kind of the feeling that because everyone is much more connected that we're all much more satisfied and happy, and it possibly couldn't be furthest from the truth. Firstly, because it's not the right sorts of connections, maybe. Also it was feeding into the aspect of cities, and this is another interesting thing that comes up. I mean, I've always lived in a big city. You've mostly lived in a big city.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah, Sheffield too is a big city too. And often they can be quite lonely places. And it's a kind of an article that looks at that side of things as well. Just because you have 8 million people around you doesn't actually make you feel any more connected to any single one of them. In fact, it can sometimes feel worse, especially again in this kind of hyper-connected world where we always feel like we're missing out on something. Especially when there's a lot happening. If there's nothing happening, there's nothing to miss out on. So I don't know. Did you read this? Did you have time to read this in the end?
I did.
What did you think?
The main thing I took out of it was they were actually talking not so much about people that being alone, as in people being spending time alone, which I actually like to do. I find it is something that is sustaining. It's a healthy thing for me to do. But it was about people. It was more about people being lonely in a crowd, that kind of idea that you may have lots of social opportunities, you've got a partner, you've got friends, you've got family, but you still feel lonely. And it gave some suggestions at sort of at the end. And I got the impression it was also sort of pushing a program that had been instigated in the UK, looking at this as a problem, particularly in older people, which you know is a little bit different to the type of alone downtime I'm proposing. Mm. It was more people, older people who may not see anyone for days.
Yeah. I found it interesting.
It was. Yeah. But what were your thoughts on it?
I think the feeling lonely in a crowd sometimes, as you know, I like to go out a lot, but I often am sat there feeling lonely. In fact, you sometimes feel more lonely in a crowd than you do at home. Because when you're just at home alone, there's no one to feel jealous of. when you're feeling lonely in a crowd, you feel like, why is no one talking to me? What's wrong with me? And stuff like that. So actually,
but you know what? I also wondered how much of it is about social etiquette. How much of it, and this is actually something I'd be interested to do a talk on and maybe get some people in to discuss. Because I often think of, like, if you give the example of, like, going to lots of social events, how often do you go to a social event and either you get, like, you'll be talking to a group of people and they all leave en masse to go outside and smoke a cigarette. So you stand there on your own going, okay. Or they suddenly, everyone gets their phones out and starts doing things on their phones.
Yeah.
Or you even, you know, I'm thinking of Berlin, a lot of us, the events here, the startup events. People don't have as many skills perhaps in networking, so they often just don't talk to people so much.
Tech people are infamously
awkward.
I think this is certainly an area where we could do, you know, an interesting chat about the whole thing as a standalone topic, because it is quite
exactly,
fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. I'd
maybe
like
we'll
to
propose
find
that for a couple of weeks.
Knowledgeable than us.
Yeah.
He's. I've got to propose one more link, and I think maybe you might have more to say on this point. I'm not sure. It ties a little bit back to what we were talking last week about the elderly. The robots for the elderly. Mm. And
robotics.
It was just... robotics. Sorry.
No, because robot suggests it's like one robot.
All right, okay.
That's all.
And I guess this interesting aspect I find always of technology ending up being more useful to a different group of people than you initially thought.
Mm.
And this was the article that you suggested again on the AI trends. Mm. You've liked that website a lot this week.
I do.
About self-driving cars actually being a boon industry for elderly people who can't drive anymore. So
yeah, look, it was quite a good article because it looked at both sides of it. The first idea was the notion that, oh, we've got older people that are less mobile. Maybe they can't drive, whether it's for health or for
safety reasons.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a nice way to say that. Degenerative reasons. So therefore, the idea being, well, self-driving cars, they can just pop in this car and, you know, off they go. And then you kind of broke it down a bit and they said, hang on, how do they get in the car? A lot of these people have mobility issues that means, you know, they can't put their leg over a, put their leg up to get up on a step or whatever, however you configure it. And then it said, well, you know, hang on, this is why traditionally a lot of older people have used either disability taxis or chauffeurs if they're at a different financial level, or had, of course, neighbours or friends or what have you to drive them places because they need someone to help them get in and out of the car. But then it goes a step further because firstly it says, okay, we could, let's look at this, let's pull this apart a bit. Okay, if that's the problem, there could be someone that could do those jobs, someone that gets people in and out of cars. You could even have someone arguably who's not actually a driver but sits in the car and makes sure the person's okay. But the more interesting part of it to me, which is something I've written about before, BMW is actually working on a project at the moment where cars are embedded with sensors and these sensors are able to detect the health of the passengers in the car. They can use it for passengers or for drivers. And so it might change the music in the car if they feel you're being stressed. Or if you're falling asleep, it may change the temperature. The seat may give you a massage.
I'm not sure if I like these recommendations. I tend to listen to very loud, aggressive music when I'm stressed because it makes me feel better.
Okay.
So I know people are different.
But it also suggests, and this is one I'm a big fan of because it's something I've read a lot about in other ways, the idea being that if it can also monitor your physiological health, it can detect if the person in the car is unwell. And does that mean a self-driving car could drive you to the hospital? That would be pretty cool, right? How cool would that be?
That's great. Yeah. I think this ties into your last topic because a lot of the issues with old people is social isolation, right? Yeah. So, you know, contact with people who drive them places and stuff, you know, may be, sadly, some of the only contact they get. So that could be a shame to remove that.
That's a very good point. This is
so
the issue, right?
Pros and cons there, I suppose.
Yeah. And let's bear in mind, I mean, these self-driving cars are going to take a while, you know.
Okay. And the final article I wanted to mention here, again, sort of feeding into this technology popping up, not where you expect it, but in a different way. And also, I mean, not wanting to get political right now, but one of the things I thought would be potentially interesting outcome, positive outcome of the kind of Trump pro-America policy would be that other parts of the world became stronger, especially Europe.
Sure.
I haven't quite seen it yet. It's not been very long, to be fair. But one area that is definitely benefiting, I think, in ways that maybe we didn't think is China. And not that China has needed much help encouraging itself. And obviously, this stuff is not new. It hasn't been happening in the past 3 months. But I especially have found it interesting to see where innovation is coming next. Like the US has generally been on top of innovation for various reasons. Where is it coming from next? And we often think of China especially as just being a place that makes our crap for us and makes our ideas, but they actually have a lot of their own.
Yeah,
they
certainly
do. An article in The Economist. Unfortunately, it uses as its measure patent applications. You've got to have something as a measure, I suppose. I wouldn't necessarily use patent registrations as the best reliable measure of innovation, but let's just go with it. And how in the past 8 years, since sort of 2008, China has almost caught up with Japan and is very, very close on the tail of America, and especially Shenzhen.
Yeah.
So Shenzhen, which is infamous for kind of an area being where stuff is made, lots of factories.
I've ordered stuff from
there. Is fast becoming a place where actually not only are they making our ideas, they're actually making a lot of their own ideas now.
Absolutely.
And I found it super interesting. I would say just read more in detail into it. But we've also heard this, I think, from someone we spoke to recently was mentioning this too.
A lot of people.
Oh, no, it was the guy we met on Tuesday, the German guy who was in China a lot, across Asia, I think.
Yeah.
He was mentioning this too. And this was open source stuff, which again is a different aspect. Just how interesting China is right now. It's a hard place to access, but there's a lot of interesting things happening there in many ways that we're not always conscious of. I find it very interesting just to see where the next hotbeds are going to be.
Yeah, there's some super good documentaries on Shenzhen in particular. It may have been Motherboard or Vice that did it, I can't quite remember. But I'll find it and link to it because it's a super good documentary. And, you know, like one of the people I write for, Nextback, they're based in Shenzhen. So, you know, I get a little look there. And additionally, there's also a super good incubator there for hardware.
There's quite a few, yeah.
There's a number of them, but this one's particularly good. It's really well known for getting people's products out there, called Hacks.
Hacks, that's it.
Yeah.
I just found it.
Oh, it's in the article, is it? Oh, okay.
Just scroll past, yeah. Just as you said it.
But they actually, you know, if you look up the products, they're all people that have successfully funded, kickstarted, they've done Y Combinators. They've you know, companies that are successful. Some are Americans from the Valley or whatever, but and one's based already in China, like Nextback.
Paul, where would you, like in the areas that you're familiar in, who would you say is a place to place or a company or a group of ideas to watch out for kind of that are really doing some more interesting thinking?
Well, I mean, where we're sat right now, actually, to be honest. I mean, I work in Better House, and every Thursday we have a startup pitching thing called Better Breakfast. They run things called hardware labs where people like try and, I don't know exactly what it is, but people design things together or something like that. I don't really know how it works, to be honest, because I'm not a technology person. Mm. There's loads going on. It's pretty impressive. It seems to be a bit of a hub, I would say.
That's great.
So they call this the Silicon Delta in Shenzhen. I think Berlin is the Silicon Alley, which...
Alley?
Yeah. Alley basically just means street. It's not really a concrete area. We could call, well, you know, that whole area around Beta House is a roundabout, but then Old Street in London claims Silicon Roundabout. Yeah. So what could be Silicon...
And you've got over 100 co-working spaces in Berlin, so you've got all
those... What's a very Berlin location that we...
Donald.
Silicon Spatey.
A Spatey for the uninitiated is like a late night shop where you can buy, you know, like a 7-Eleven or convenience store. You can buy, you know, lots of alcohol, but also
and nothing healthy.
Snacks that you would consume with alcohol.
Maybe some couscous once in a while if you're lucky. Yeah. That's about it.
Yeah, a bit hard if you're doing the no wheat, I think. No wheat, no sugar.
So just wrapping up, Kate, what articles have you written this week that have been published that you'd like people to go out and read?
An old one kind of resurfaced that I forgot I wrote about, which is always a nice thing when, you know, something's been sitting there and comes to be published, which was about bone conduction used in wearable tech. There's a range of products at the moment where the bones in your face are used as a conduit for sound as opposed to the ear. And you've got things from headphones to sunglasses that can play music. You've got a little device that looks like a James Bond that, you know, attaches to your finger and then you touch your face to be able to make phone calls. There's a range of different ways this technology is being used. And I'll hasten to add, this is quite an old technology. It's believed that, is it Beethoven that was the composer that was deaf?
Yeah.
He used to use bone conduction as a means to hear when he was conducting. And a lot of the devices, what they do is they enable that I can wear, say, a pair of sunglasses that's got music on them, like the Zangle ones, and no one else can hear the music except me because they're attached to my face. So it's really quite cool stuff.
Any other articles? Is that the main one this week?
There is, but I can't remember about this second.
Okay. And two from me this week. I had, again, one that I wrote a little while ago that finally got published, was my article, The Realities of Being a Digital Nomad, which especially was focusing a little bit more on now, as I am on the downward side of my 30s, or the upward side, depending how you look at it.
You know what, Chris? I think we should also do a show on that.
Okay, but just have a read of the article. It's kind of more talking about what starts to happen if you've lived in a few countries and haven't had any solid roots when you start thinking about pension plans and health insurance and things like that. Yeah. The kind of more pragmatic stuff. That was on Envato. It was a new outlet for me. And also, a complete other end of the spectrum, one of my articles for DZone this week was JVM-free Kotlin. And if that means anything to you, you'll be very excited and you could just look into it. But have a look on DZone. Paul, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
One last time, tell us about your event at the end of the month.
So there's a biohacking party in collaboration with Better House. So there's going to be organic beer, which is not really healthy, but it's healthier. There's going to be ozonated water, hopefully liquid nitrogen ice cream, possibly some ketogenic guy from a low-carb cafe is going to be there. Mm. Music, there's going to be sound massage therapy, all body sound. So we're going to plug in the sound system through to a system which will vibrate your own whole body, which has all kinds of interesting impact, which is quite biohackery. You put guys might quite like that. So it's just going to be a fun social thing.
Recipe. We will certainly link to that on our podcast this week.
Great.
So all the information will be there, and we will share it on our social media as well.
So this has been Chris.
And Kate.
And Paul.
For another episode of Gregarious Mammal Podcast, and we will see you next week.